Okay. Well, I understand you are in the throes of Nundro, and it is quite a ride. I have to say, of all the practices I've done in over 3 decades, I've been what my wife calls spiritually promiscuous and have done an awful lot of practices, but I really have loved Nundro as much as any. And this comes from someone who was very resistant to doing it. When I first started sitting with Surya and he was teaching primarily Dzogchen, I was absolutely convinced there was no way I was going to do another spiritual boot camp, which is what I interpreted Nundro as. And I assiduously avoided any possibility of doing it. But the more I hung around, the more I began to get these intimations there was something quite valuable here. And I tried it, and it became very impressive. And then there was one day I was sitting in retreat, and the thought came, I really should do this, which stage I had this minor panic attack. I ran to one of the teachers to discuss this psychosis. And Surya did something very skillful. He said, well, you know, there is this category, the 10%er, you just do 10% of them. So I figured, oh, okay, I could handle that. And, of course, by the time I was into 10%, it was getting clear that this was something quite remarkable. And so spent a couple of years and about, 3-4 months or so in retreat doing these. I started formally in an unusual way. I just had actually come to hear Lama Paulden, and she'd talked about the ways you could do the prostrations if your body gave out. I remember this thought arising, thinking, well, that's not going to happen to me. And, of course, life has a way of humbling one, and the body humbles us all sooner or later. And so it wasn't long before I crashed. And so I began, Lama Paulden suggested you could do circumambulation. So I started my formal circumambulations on the deck of a cruise ship in Tahiti. going round this cruise ship. And it was a nice way of beginning. Probably unusual, but it was nice. But the more I got into these practices, the more I came to appreciate them and appreciate that these were just extraordinarily profound teachings and practices, which, as I said, embody the whole path, and I don't doubt that at all. And I've come to feel that these practices operate in so many ways, on so many levels, and so many dimensions that I don't pretend to understand all the ways they operate in the mind. I certainly feel that they are operating on multiple levels and through multiple processes. But I really did come to feel that they were working in depths and ways, both conscious and unconscious, that I'm still fathoming. I understand most of you are working with Vajrasattva, so I thought I'd center on that. But before doing so, let me just give a little context or background, some ideas which may be helpful. Nundro is essentially, like so many of the Vajrayana practices, one of the visualization series of a family of visualization practices, and therefore it'd probably be very good to know something about the nature of visualization imagery and how we understand that. And it's interesting, you know, clearly of all the world's psychologies and traditions, probably the Jungians are the masters of visualization in the West, and the Tibetans are the world masters of visualization. And so given that, how do we understand visualization imagery? I think one thing that's very important is to let's just start with some definitions. Firstly, images are things that portray something. But symbols are something deeper. Symbols, which is what we're really working with here, represent deeper levels of meaning. That is, a symbol is an image, but it's not simply a portrayal of something. It's actually something which points to or embodies multiple levels of meaning. And then there's another family of symbols which are very important to know about, because they're crucial to to a lot of these practices, and that is auto-symbolic imagery or auto-symbolic symbols. Auto-symbolic images are ones which symbolize our state of mind and state of being. For example, if you get very angry and have an image of fire or of yourself clubbing someone over the head, those are images which portray the state of mind. Now, one of the things that's really interesting about images is that they also not only can express and portray states of mind, but they evoke those corresponding states of mind. And this is the genius of these practices and so much of the Vajrayana, that they use symbols in a way to evoke specific states of mind. And it's also important to realize that symbols can portray multiple levels. They can portray different levels of the psyche. And it's also important to realize that these symbols are what are called polyvalent, which is a fancy way of saying they have many meanings and many layers of meaning. So one of the things that becomes very apparent as you work with the Nundro is that these images we are deliberately evoking are clearly rich symbolic imagery, and those symbols can be understood at many different levels of meaning. And one of the things that happens during the practice is that in my experience, the symbols continue to unveil successive layers of meaning and significance to us in ways we can't even appreciate at the beginning. And a nice way of understanding this, or analogy to the latent meaning that can be hidden within these Nundro images, is if you think of what would happen, you imagine an animal running across this unfamiliar object which is hard and doesn't taste good and has this funny black and white markings. And then imagine a native from a tribal tradition coming to it and finding it's this very curious object, which is rectangular but opens and has filled with curious markings which don't mean anything. And then imagine a child from our culture finding it, realizing, oh, it's a book. And then an adult from our culture finding it, realizing it's a book, but it's a ridiculous one, doesn't make any sense. And then imagine a quantum physicist finding it and realizing it's a profound treatise on quantum physics. Now, what's really interesting in each of those cases is everyone was right. The animal was right. It didn't taste good. The kid was right. It was a book. The quantum physicist was right. It's a profound physics text. Now, it's interesting that each animal or being was receiving the same sensory input. And they were only able to comprehend it up to their own level of development. This is what's called adequatio. We only comprehend that to which we are adequate. Okay? And symbols contain what are called grades of significance, or levels of meaning. And we only can comprehend the grades of significance or levels of meaning which correspond to our own developmental level, or just a little above it. The symbols have the capacity of pulling us to the next level if we are open to them. Now, the other thing that's really interesting about the symbols and that story is, although each being was receiving the same sensory input and getting some significance from them, their experience contained no information that they were missing still higher levels. Okay? So we can be viewing these images or visualizations and perhaps getting profound messages from them, and yet at the same time be unaware that there are still higher grades of significance, still deeper levels of meaning that we may be completely missing. But fortunately, because these are auto-symbolic imagery, because they symbolize states of mind, they have the capacity to pull those same states of mind out of us and actually catalyze development towards the highest or deepest levels of meaning, depth, significance that they contain. Okay. And that's the genius of these things as far as I can conceive, that as far as I can get it, these teachings or these practices, this is Roger's theory of the origin of Nundro, so take it with the appropriate cautions. But my guess is that there were people doing very profound practice, and out of their depths of realization arose these images and visions which symbolized their states of mind, which they then communicated as a teaching, knowing that these visualizations have the capacity to induce the same states of mind in us. And I don't know about you, but my experience doing these practices is almost like, it feels like a mind-to-mind transmission. It feels like having my mind stretched and pulled and opened, fight as I may, towards the same kind of vast expanse and depth from which they came. So it literally feels like a mind-to-mind transmission that's being given to us from these things. Any comments, questions?
In your analogy about the book, animal and kid, and not having another sense, but not having that sense that we're missing something, and it seems to me like there is a sense that there's more. You know what I'm saying? Like, even though I don't know what it is,
mm-hmm.
or like even that kid might have known there's more than they know yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, fair enough. So there may be intimations, and certainly we're in a context. You know, one of the beauties of being in a tradition is that we're in a context of receiving teachings which point us to that more. And we also have the expectation. I mean, it's like, you know, we have the expectation that there's something very profound here. And we're told by people who've been there that it's very profound, so yeah. And I think you're probably also pointing to something else, a kind of deeper intuitive knowing. My assumption is that the being multi-level symbols, these resonate with different levels of our psyche. And although we may not be fully aware of the deeper levels of resonance, we, you know, probably intuit something. So I think that's a good point. Yeah, thank you. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
One of the you know, they say in the tradition in Mahamudra, you know, and that being translated as a great seal or great symbol, is that which is being symbolized and that which it is are not different, are not separate.
Well, I assume since the Mahamudra is everything, that's probably a safe bet. But you're saying more than that, right?
So that the image and what it represents are not in any way separate.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of Vajrayana imagery, that's operating. But of course, also in terms of everything that is. That everything is a symbol.
Beautiful.
Revealing true nature to us, revealing teaching to us. And the symbol in its... Yeah, its meaning and its reality of what it is are not separated.
That's why I like hanging out with you. You one up me. It's great. This is the beauty of the tradition. Yeah. Anyone else?
So is what you're saying? Like symbol.
Right.
And so the thing that we designate as symbol helps us to look back and see that the perceiver has and the world perceived that we see is real, and that which is symbolized gets to be seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And while we're on symbols and imagery, it's interesting, there's a whole field of research these days looking at the effects of imagery, and it's clear that visualization tends to evoke the same neuronal firings, etc., as real experience. The brain reacts in the same way, so it's a very efficient way of producing some very powerful experiences. Okay, so with that context, let's take a look at Vajrasattva, which I understand you are diving into at the moment, which is great because I think of all the Nundro practices, this is my favorite. I just was so blown away by this practice. I remember at the end of I finished it, I think, at the end of a couple of months retreat. And I was thinking, the last time I did it, I was thinking, boy, this is still just opening and deepening with each time. So clearly, as far as I can see, this is a practice which operates on multiple dimensions of mind, multiple layers of mind, and multiple realms of reality. So what I thought I'd do is just run through the stages of the practice and look at the various elements. Starting, of course, it starts with confession and regret. We begin with acknowledging and confessing mistakes. And clearly this in and of itself is a very powerful practice. Confession is a central practice in every spiritual tradition that I know of, and is a key element now in psychotherapy and groups such as AA. There's something just in ways that I don't think anyone really understands that's extraordinarily healing about just sharing with another person openly and defenselessly one's stupidities. It's just very healing. And, of course, vastly more so if that confession is heard by someone who is empathic and caring and compassionate. Something just, you know, some of us make a living out of that fact. So regret, so there's the confession and the cultivation of regret. And clearly regret can be very helpful and very powerful. And in the Buddhist psychology, of course, this is one of the so-called guardians of rectitude, one of the mental qualities or mental factors, which is a, quote, guardian of rectitude. However, there is a trap. And it's a trap I don't see written about in the traditional texts. So I think it's worth taking a look at. And that is, I think that there is a trap, and the trap is guilt. And nowhere do I find a clear distinction in the traditional literature between regret and guilt. Anyone want to take a stab at what they see as the difference? Please.
Just in a simple way, would be guilt hangs around, regret moves through. Or I guess in a momentary way, you can regret and release it by bringing awareness to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then for me, guilt seems like it's still there. Yeah.
Takes around.
You're not really letting it go.
Yeah, there's a wonderful saying, guilt is the gift which keeps on giving.
and I have none of it in doing the Vajrasattva practice. So it was very interesting when you just made that question. I think what you said is true. And there's something about the purifying and the cleansing and the being in the moment and the looking directly at the guilt, just it never comes up.
Wonderful.
You know, I may be being simplistic, but that's my experience. In fact, I kind of marvel at how
I think that's your years of work that you brought to the practice and also the way you're doing your practice, you know.
I was just going to comment that it seems that the process where one in acknowledging obscurations and faults moves from what would traditionally be experienced as guilt in this culture and learns to see it as a regret in terms of recognizing one's actions can be faulted. So it seems like there's a process that, that for me personally, that's where I saw the movement to as Vajrasattva became a recognition of a more beneficent kind of energy to treat it in terms of a more benevolent one.
Yeah.
I think guilt feels more helpless to me. I feel powerless, and therefore feeling guilty is something that I can do. But doing the Vajrasattva, I'm doing something, so I don't have to feel guilty.
Ah, that's good. Okay, yes, that's interesting.
It's empowering.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, those are a couple of interesting things. I hadn't thought of that. You know, so the very fact of having a practice to work with reduces guilt. Yes, which is exactly what it's designed to do. So, as far as I can see, guilt is regret plus self-attack. You know, the really crucial element is there's an element of self-attack, and it's not I made a mistake and that's unfortunate. It's I sinned and I'm bad. And what's worse, I deserve to be punished. Guilt basically asks for punishment. And within the mind, whatever you ask for, you get. You know, the mind is very obliging like that. And of course, the tragedy is that in our culture, guilt is accepted as appropriate. We don't have a skillful understanding of guilt in this culture. It's like if you screw up, it's quite appropriate that you should feel guilty. Please.
It also seems like it's a diminishment of one's own value.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
Whereas regret, this is not necessarily an augmentation of one's value, but at least a neutrality.
Yeah. Yes. So as far as I can see, as opposed to regret, guilt is more painful, self-destructive, self-perpetuating, which was what Colleen was getting at, and here's one a very interesting possibility. As far as I can see, at a certain level of maturity, probably unnecessary. An unnecessary emotion, not only a destructive emotion, but an unnecessary one, which is very different from our cultural understanding. Our cultural understanding is if you didn't feel guilt, you'd be a psychopath and prone to, you know, do damage. As far as I can see, at a certain level of I suspect that guilt is a stage-specifically appropriate emotion. Beyond a certain developmental stage, it's just dysfunctional. But without that understanding, we feel guilty if we don't feel guilty. You know, it's very weird. So what's the skillful strategy? Well, clearly, I think it's very useful to differentiate guilt and regret and know that distinction. And I think it's also helpful to practice seeing our mistakes as errors or mistakes rather than as something bad or evil. And look at our acts in terms of helpfulness or unhelpfulness rather than good or bad. And it's very interesting if you look at people who work with guilt and regret as opposed to those who get entrapped by them. Basically, neurotic people screw up, feel guilty, beat themselves up, and repeat the screw-ups. You know, healthy people screw up, recognize it, acknowledge it, and clean it up and learn from it. You know, there was a time in my naive youth, not so long ago, when I thought that there were people, you know, if you really woke up, you wouldn't screw up. Well, I haven't found anyone who doesn't screw up. But I have found people who clean up after themselves and do it very fast. And that is, you know, that I think is a hallmark of maturity. Okay, so first we practice the regret, and then move on to the nectar cleansing. And it's very interesting, you know, clearly this is something very powerful that works. We've got this image of purifying ourselves, nectar passing through us, washing out all our gunk. And somehow it works, even though I haven't a clue how. I'm not sure anyone does, except that, as we're talking about, presumably the visualization evokes the same kind, you know, evokes the appropriate patterns in mind and brain. But then it gets extremely interesting. I think of this practice as being a psychological and spiritual judo of the highest level. Because what it does is it takes our negativity and turns it into a gift. So basically, all the screw-ups we've done now become the means for us to make an offering to beings. And this seems to work in so many ways and be so powerful. First off, simply giving gifts is a very powerful practice itself. And in many traditions, you find that giving a gift is offered as a way of reparation for people we've harmed. And paradoxically, it's also recommended as a practice for people who've harmed you. If you're really angry with someone, give them a gift. It's very hard for them to stay angry with you or you to stay angry with them. And you find that across a number of traditions. And in this practice, we're asked to give our karmic debtors whatever it is they want and need. Now, and this does a couple of interesting things, as you probably notice in your own mind. First, you have to look and see what is it these people most need. What would be healing for them, reparative, or just beneficial? And then give it to them, or visualize giving it to them. I notice in my own mind that creates a wonderful shift in motivation towards these people. It cultivates feelings of generosity, love, care, compassion, etc., which, of course, do what's called reciprocally inhibit negative emotions such as anger or jealousy or whatever the emotions may be. And one of the principles that you find operating here time and time again, as in so much Dharma, is this principle what psychologists now call reciprocal inhibition. That is, certain qualities of mind reciprocally inhibit one another. You can't be angry and loving at the same time. You can't be joyous and fearful. So much of Dharma consists of cultivating positive qualities such as love, compassion, empathic joy, partly for their own benefit, but partly because they inhibit the corresponding negative qualities. You know, empathic joy is an antidote for jealousy. You can't be jealous and empathically joyful at the same time. So one way to work with jealousy is to deliberately work with that emotion, try to release it, and blah, blah, blah. Or you can simply cultivate its opposite, and it will inhibit it. You cultivate empathic joy, and that inhibits the jealousy. And the other element that is at work here clearly is one of the crucial psychological principles underlying so much of these practices and of Dharma in general, is that within the mind, what you intend for another, you tend to experience yourself. We can play with that a little more later, but basically it's a very powerful principle. Whatever you intend for another person to experience, you tend to experience yourself. You want someone else to feel loving, guess where you have to generate the feelings of love first. Okay? So, and this is the basis of the core basis of key practices such as Brahma Vihara practice and the offering practice. Now, being translated, yes. So this offering of our mistakes and negative karma and transmuting it into a gift does something very interesting in my experience. It actually reframes our mistakes. That is, what we had been holding as errors are now, or mistakes, or things to be regretted or even felt guilty about, now are seen as our gifts to people. And somehow that just takes an enormous amount of the charge off. And it's very interesting to think that through and realize that, and you can again see it at many levels, that our mistakes are now the fodder in this visualization for the gifts, and they allow us to see that our mistakes are something we can learn from and be of greater benefit from. And with that reframe, it's very hard to hold any guilt or negativity around them. Comments, questions?
Well, no, he's actually the Nindro and the Lodrige is slightly different. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So.
Also, the principle applies in terms of what's being released going, you know, either into the mouth of the Garuda or in the golden ground. It becomes bodhicitta fertilizer in the golden ground, and it's a gift that way. In different Nindros, it's a little bit different, the specifics of how it happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Either way, if you, you know, if it's giving, yeah, if you're giving,
yeah,
if you're giving it to karmic debtors or to the yama or whoever, it still works in the same way.
Well, my it just brings up for me, Roger, like many times in the early days of the Rinpoches, there'd be this discussion about regret or guilt or. And sometimes the Tibetans have used the translation of shame or guilt, but they use shame in a good way, in a positive sense, that kind of like regret or like shame, like they use an example like you wouldn't walk naked maybe into, you know, like a shrine room if that was a bunch of monks there or something. That would be shameful, like that's a positive thing. Or the regret or guilt. But so they very much counsel people like, oh, guilt is, no, don't feel guilty. Completely just leave that aside or let that go. But they couldn't necessarily articulate for people in those early days and early translations and stuff of how one would do that. I mean, outside of telling us to do the practices, you know. So in some Westerners had the experience of, okay, you know, my lama's saying, forget the guilt, that's totally useless. They're totally not into guilt if you're around Himalayan people. They're just not into guilt. It's not part of their deal. They do the regret and let go, like Colleen was saying, and that's what the Rinpoches were saying, you know, and what you're saying. But I think what you're explaining is really helpful because to understand how the practice helps us work in that way, because the Rinpoches weren't really, when I heard them talk about this, able to really articulate how we would do that. It actually, in some sense, the guilt was so far outside their psychological framework that they just didn't know how to address it, really, or deal with it. And, you know, certain things are like that, like the low self-esteem thing, too. It's just so outside their framework, you know. But it's in the practice, as you're explaining, you know, as we work with it.
Yeah, it has the antidote, so I think it's just helpful to
understand
it, because I think there are some ways in which, you know, if you just an appropriate understanding can just shortcut it,
right.
A lot of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think that's the part that, like, you know, it's very helpful to hear you say how you've understood and figured this out, and as Westerners come to do these practices and figure out, because the way we need to language it for us to really get it is very different than it was for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, since the psychological situation is quite different.
Yeah, and I have to say, awful lot of this is my own experimentation and may or may not turn out to be correct, but this is my current understanding, subject to revision.
Yeah. Well, and that's the nature of Vajrayana practice, to reveal itself as you practice it.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think that's what one has to trust in.
Yeah, one of the things that surprised me doing these and other practices is really how much experimentation is really involved. It's like I assumed I was getting the full instructions, then you realize there are infinite number of ways you can vary this or that, and I've just found extremely valuable to experiment.
And I think that's an important thing that sometimes Westerners miss, like, well, exactly what, how do you, this and that, and there are a lot of, detailed teachings, but that's not really the spirit of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And people feel like, oh, it's all very tight and tense. And I kind of try to say, no, it's really not. It's totally a creative process. There's this freedom within the, there's certain elements of the form, but it's a creative experimentation in that,
Yeah, and it's also, in my experience, creative at a level far beyond this little ego. That is that, if I just sit down and do these, then images come up and they take on a life of their own, as imagery does. And, it gets clear that something much bigger than this ego is running this game. And these images and symbols are coming from somewhere way deeper, and I better just go along for the ride and trust. And I would have to say one of the greatest gifts I have gotten out of therapy and Dharma practice is realizing that the mind can be trusted. That, we, in our culture, and I don't know how universal this is, I'd love to know, but certainly in our culture, there seems to be a widespread basic assumption that we're at war with our own minds. We can't trust the mind or ourselves. We have to keep ourselves under control, blah, blah, or else. And one of the great gifts is to recognize we don't have to spend a lifetime guarding the mind. The mind is given the appropriate conditions of an openness to experience, the mind is self-healing, self-regulating, self-actualizing, self-transcending, and self-liberating. It's a very fine machine if we just give it the right conditions and realize that it works much better if we don't try to run it.
That's the part I don't trust.
You have a wonderful discovery ahead of you.
That's when I try to start running and it goes wrong.
Oh, okay. I see what you mean. Yeah. 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 Any other comments?
I think it's a subtle distinction because in one hand in Dharma we're grabbing hold of the mind to direct it and to focus attention and to become masters of our mind so this bullshit thought trip isn't just running itself. And on the other hand, there's what Roger's talking about, I think, that the realization we don't need to run the whole thing. So it's kind of like both of those are involved, both the grabbing hold and surrendering simultaneously.
Yeah, and I think what you're pointing to, and which would have been smarter if I'd done it, is that there's actually, it's best thought of as a developmental process. When we begin, we start with intentionally training and directing, and the further practices go, the more it becomes an allowing and an opening and a receptivity. And as far as I can see, as you certainly see it in the Vajrayana, I mean, you spend couple of decades of going through all these incredibly elaborate practices, and then they say, just rest with awareness. Well, why didn't you tell me 20 years ago? Well, because you couldn't do it.
Exactly like horseback riding or riding a bike or, especially something, like a dance, I know you were a diver and stuff. Yeah, it's like, in order to really be able to have that freedom on horseback or that freedom diving or that freedom singing, the training is essential in the beginning. Mm. And then the creative process, the freedom, the relaxation,
Yeah. But to add on to that, and I think there's a way of skillfully bringing these together, and that is even early on, we have to be directive and to whatever extent we can understand that trusting the mind is a skillful attitude, I think it very much facilitates that, even that early stage. Yeah.
That's like my horseback rider trainer keeps yelling at me, like, all these things I have to do, and then he's like, relax, relax, breathe. I'm like, how am I supposed to relax when you're telling me to remember all these things? He goes, don't think about it, just do it.
Right.
And he's trying to get me to do both of these things simultaneously. But
hope you have a good horse.
The funny thing is, you know, for like at my age, to like Terry was saying, learning whole new things, you know, is very difficult physically. But the kids pick it up like that, so they can't have the kids and adults in the same class because the kids learn five times as fast. You know, how to do that sort of, you know, this process. Right. That's what we're praying to meet our teachers young next time.
Right. Yeah. Please.
It seems that there's a developmental process that we don't have to run the whole thing. Have you identified like the steps that we go through as we drop away from not identifying with it, letting the mind sort of co-create and get out of the way? You know what I'm saying? As steps of how we learn our self-regulation and self-evolving and self-healing kinds of state. Does it parallel any of the psyche of the psychiatric psychological states that have been identified in the literature?
I don't think psychology is even vaguely aware of this possibility. You know, Western psychotherapy is at the stage of deliberate manipulation and working with mind. The idea of simply allowing mind to rest and be is quite foreign to the Western psychology as yet. And it's starting to come in now that mindfulness-based therapies are starting to become popular, but it's got a long way to go. So no, it's a good question. I haven't thought about. Please.
I just wanted to thank you for that whole piece about confessions as gifts. I mean, it's something I haven't gotten to yet, and I love that image a lot. Mm. And the power of turning these things into positive action.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I also appreciate, too, the piece of how they do start to have a life with them. Because I've been having experiences in the refuge practice of a shamanic animal, like our animal, has started to come to me and doing things with me. And at first I said, oh, no, I can't do this. And it has been very powerful, the connection of the lineage I was speaking about the other day through this power, that has started to come into practice. So I
was letting it happen, but just your mentioning that gives me more
confidence just to allow, you know, staying within the practice, but allowing these things to
come. Yeah, it can be really wonderful. Maybe I can just share something about a similar thing that came up for me in doing the prostrations there were, and the refuge tree at first, it was, you know, this lineage, and then other lineages appeared, and then other religions appeared, until finally it was all the world's religions. And then they kind of, then over the months, the imagery just evolved to seeing them all going back to prehistoric sources, and then back to the roots of evolution, and then back to the beginnings of life. And then it was all manifestation, and then behind that was the one mind creating it all, both as all this was an expression of the one mind, and then this bowing was being done by the one mind to itself. And it's like, well, this little ego didn't plan that, you know. So... and it was just wonderful to, I mean, I had no idea that was going to happen. I certainly didn't plan it, but it was absolutely wonderful and ecstatic to have the sense of not bowing, but of being bowed and practiced through. And again, the genius of the practice, I mean, you know, the instructions are laid out there, and then somehow, with the understanding that the mind will use it in its own appropriate way, each individual mind will use it in its own way, and who knows what will come out.